This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Faye Williams, the veteran activist. She's in Washington, D.C. and was a few blocks away from the tragedy at the Naval Yard on Monday. We'll talk with Faye Williams about what happened and where we go from here. She has some viewpoints that I'm sure are at odds with those of our other guest in the front part of the show, Scott Wilfong, veteran Republican political consultant. We'll talk about gun control and much more with Faye and Scott. Also on the show, Mike Marshall. That's Dr. Mike Marshall, the intellectual of baseball. He holds the record for most games pitched in the American League and the National League. Once pitched in 106 games in 1974 for the Los Angeles Dodgers. Mike Marshall will talk about what's going on involving fastballs that are now zooming past 100 miles an hour. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your local number outside the area. It is 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We begin with veteran activist Faye Williams, former congressional candidate. Dr. Faye Williams has been named many times as one of the 100 most influential African Americans in the U.S. by Ebony Magazine. She's joining us from Washington, and in studio we will hear from Scott Wilfong, Republican political consultant who's been with us a time or two. The shooting at the Washington Navy Yard earlier this week by a man who authorities say showed telltale signs of mental illness is spurring a push to move ahead with bipartisan mental health policy changes. As a result, the new gun control debate may not be over weapons, but could focus on how to spend money on mental health care. Faye Williams, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing well, and as I noted, you weren't so far away when this tragedy occurred.
Well, actually, I'm right down the street from the Navy Yard, which is reopening this morning, a part of it anyway, not building 197, but it's walking distance from both my home and my office. So Monday was a very tragic day for us nearby. I mean, it was tragic for the whole world, but certainly even more so for those of us who live in the area just down the street from where all of this happened. No one could have imagined it, because this Navy Yard is one of the most secure buildings, and I've been in the building. I've spoken there for a Women's Day event. I have many friends who work there, and I'm still getting stories about friends who were there, who were, you know, hunkered down during the shooting, and some of them, of course, are experiencing very traumatic problems themselves at this time.
12 people were killed, and I understand today in Washington you're part of an event this afternoon that will address gun rights, gun control. What's going to happen today?
Absolutely. Well, it's been going on more than just today, but my role in it today will be simply calling the names of victims of gun violence. I'll be on around 12:15 today at the United States Capitol, and we have vowed to be there until, you know, action is taken on gun violence, some sensible legislation to try to do all we can to prevent situations such as happened here on Monday, and that's happened in Newtown and Colorado and Virginia Tech and so many other places around the country. I mean, it's time for even gun enthusiasts to get serious and to want to at least have some kind of legislation, not to take away people's guns, but to limit who can get them, certainly in the cases of people who have a history, a record, or obvious potential for doing something like what happened on Monday.
Well, Scott Wilfong is a gun enthusiast. Scott, what's your take on whether or not this tragedy on Monday will spur the kind of action that Faye Williams is advocating?
Well, you know, I'm glad to see, and I support anything that will help reduce gun violence. You know, let's look at the things that have been proposed in the past year. To my knowledge, none of the things, background checks, limiting ammunition capacity, limiting the types of guns like AR-15s, none of that would have prevented what happened on Monday. In fact, I think the gentleman had a Remington 870, which that gun is even on Dianne Feinstein's approved gun list. It's the most common shotgun in America. He used a shotgun. He had approximately 24 rounds of ammunition. He passed a background check and got security clearance on September 14th. So all the things that the gun grabbers and the anti-freedom crowd has tried to push, absolutely none of those things would have done anything to prevent what happened Monday. But I do commend Dr. Williams for working on the mental health issues, and there are types of things that can be done legislatively to make sure that guns don't get into the hands of these people, because it was clear the guy was a threat. He had already identified himself as such to law enforcement, and the problem happened with somehow his this information was not passed on to the correct people.
And I agree with you, Scott. I see this is the time when maybe we do agree. I say this because a common element among the recent mass shootings has been attribution of some level of mental illness upon the shooters. I mean, the shooters have felt that somebody had wronged them, or they were hearing voices. That is the kind of thing. So, yeah, we do need to pay more attention to mental health, but I think the way we pay attention to it also is to have better background checks.
Well,
Captain Kelly, the remark Kelly, went around the country and was able to buy all kinds of guns in just 5 minutes. I don't think that's an adequate background check. And obviously, in the case of Mr. Alexis, there was no adequate background check, or these mental health problems would have been picked up.
Well, he got governmental security clearance, which is something that I myself and 99% of all Americans never subject themselves to. So we have to ask the question, where was the sharing of information among law enforcement on this guy?
All right, 297-5633, 877-217-5757 for Dr. Fay Williams and Scott Wilfong. We begin with Elwood in Atlanta. Good morning, Elwood.
Good morning. According to the Texas Department of Public Safety, you are 66% more likely to be involved in a crime involving a weapon if you are a licensed person to carry a concealed weapon. In Atlanta Sunday, a couple going to the Falcons game stopped at a Subway. They got in front of a person in line, and that person later shot that couple in the parking lot. And a Mr. Smith, a man with a record of manslaughter, was recently arrested. He's a white supremacist and an anti-Semite. He was recently arrested for having an arsenal of weapons after being convicted of manslaughter and a huge stash of ammunition. Now, if a person like that could obtain weapons of mass death and destruction, we're doing something wrong in this country. And we simply have too many weapons with people who don't have the mental capacity to operate those weapons in a civilized manner. And thank God for Obamacare that covers mental health, something the NRA has called for, more mental health, and something the Tea Party opposes when it comes to Obamacare.
Scott, he gave you a lot to work with.
Boy, that was rapid fire, no pun intended. The idea, though, that of what the caller's talking about, you know, part of it has merit, but I'd like to find out where we think we're going to get to the point of getting those 400 million guns that are in America off the street. We need to talk about real solutions that have any sort of opportunity of succeeding. And there's 400 million guns in America. We're not getting them all back in the box. We're not all rounding them up. Even if we were successful in getting 90% of them off the street, which would be the greatest governmental success in history, you'd still have 40 million guns largely in the hands of criminals. So to even discuss those options is really a waste of time. We need to talk about things that have real-world possibilities of success, like mental health legislation, things like that, that will stop these crazy people from getting their hands on guns. I don't know about the part if you have a permit, you're more likely to be involved in a gun crime. I don't think any of those 26 people in Connecticut had permits or were carrying guns at the time.
Well, you know, Scott, I think what we who are looking for something to do just simply want gun enthusiasts to work with us to do it enthusiastically and find a way, rather than, you know, we hear the discussion from the gun enthusiasts of what can't be done. We want to discuss what can be done and do it in a spirit of, you know, let's work together, let's find the solution. But I think we've been blocked on every corner, no matter what it is we're proposing. I'm glad to hear you saying that we do have to deal with the mental health aspect of it. That's one thing we can accomplish together if only the Congress and legislatures would settle down and stop all the hate Obama. Let's don't do it because Obama is proposing it, and work on some real solutions. We can come up with some.
Dr. Peter Crawford calling. Good morning to you. You're on the air with Dr. Phil Fay Williams and Scott Wilfong. Hi, Peter.
Good morning.
Yes,
I hope
sir. Everyone
is well today.
Yes. What's your question?
My question, you're touching on it a little bit, but you're looking more towards preventing guns from getting in the hands of people with mental illnesses. The treatment of mental illness is a huge problem in Baton Rouge and across the country. The access for these people to get help is extremely limited. So it's not the guns that are killing people. I agree that it's the guns getting into the hands of people that have problems. What are we going to do to get these people the help that they need in order to prevent them from having these tendencies to go and harm other people? These are people who need help. They need help, and we shouldn't stigmatize them. We should make sure that they have access.
And that's why we need folks. I don't know if you're a mental health professional or of some sort, but we need people with that level of expertise to enter the discussion and enter the conversation. Because unfortunately, every time a solution gets brought up, at least on the federal level, it always goes back to, well, let's take away the guns, let's subject law-abiding citizens to more regulations, let's put more strings on people who want to do the right thing, and just try to take away the freedoms that the Second Amendment offers. If we can get off of that and realize that that's not going to happen, that's not going to be possible, and thank God we have an amendment to the Constitution that protects our rights to that, then we can talk about real solutions. But it's the red meat, the Democrat talking points of let's get those bad AR-15s off the street. Well, 13 people lost their lives. 12 innocent people lost their lives Monday at the hands of a Remington shotgun. I think we need to get the debate back on track here, folks.
I think we have to get over the fact that it's a Democrat or Republican issue. This is an issue we have in America. And, of course, Louisiana, which is my home state, is one of the states that does not seem to want to get better care to work with those who are mentally ill. You should be talking to Governor Jindal and letting him know that the health care bill would give more service to people who are mentally ill or who are showing signs of mental illness. But, again, that's being blocked, and I'm not going to just blame it on the Republicans. I'm going to just say any governor, any legislator, anybody who is trying to block the fact that we could get better mental health care under the Affordable Care Act. They are contributing to the problem because that's a place, it seems, as Scott is saying, we can agree we need better services.
David on Airline. Good morning, David. You're on with Scott and Fay. Hi, David.
Hello, good morning. Just a few things to set the record straight a little bit. Mentally ill people are 5 times more likely to be the victim of a violent crime than to commit a violent crime. From 2006 to 2010, there were 156 mass shootings, and a lot of those were not mentally ill people. In New Orleans earlier this year, we had an incident on Mother's Day of all days, and no one seems to talk about that. They only talk about the outlandish ones that happen, like in Washington, D.C. But certainly in Louisiana, we spend $62 per capita on mental health. The average state spends $121. But I just want to point out that there's a lot of shootings that have nothing to do with mentally ill people. Just your response about that.
You are right about that, and I saw a statistic recently that said, in mass shootings involving more than three people, every single time the only way they're ended is a confrontation with another person with a gun. So, we need to get also onto the idea of security. I remember when the Fort Hood shooting happened a few years ago, I'll admit my naivety that I thought, how could this possibly happen? It's a military base. These are soldiers. Don't they have guns to stop a crazy man who's shooting people? Well, if you go back to 1993, our great president Bill Clinton's the one that instituted that policy, that our soldiers can't arm themselves on a military installation in our country. What ultimately stopped this man on Monday? A good guy with a gun.
Fay? Would you respond to Scott, please?
Well, I'm not quite sure where he was going with that, but obviously there are guns on military bases, whether everybody has one or not. I still believe that we have to face the fact that someone who commits an horrific crime as the ones that we've been talking about can't be mentally well. I mean, they've got to have a mental problem. So to say that everybody doesn't have a mental problem, I think that's really short-sighted.
We'll talk more with Fay Williams and Scott Wilfong when we return in 90 seconds. 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Back in a moment. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. InksterShow@WRKF.org by email. Scott Wilfong, veteran Republican consultant, and Faye Williams, longtime Democratic activist who was a few blocks away when the shooting began, and 12 people were killed Monday at the Washington Navy Yard. We'll talk with Scott and Faye in our remaining time about this and a few other items. And if you have a question on this or other topics, we invite you to do so. 877-217-5757, wherever you may be. Now, Faye Williams, you've been the most vocal peace activist I've known in many years. And I'm sure that your support for President Obama hasn't faded. But nonetheless, were you pleased when he called for military action in Syria?
Well, obviously I wasn't. I am, as you said, a peace activist, and I'm an honest one. I'm totally for trying negotiations of problems anytime there are problems that come up. And I'm proud of the fact that the president, even though he's been lambasted, he's been talked about badly, that he did decide to allow the team, including a secretary or led by Secretary Kerry, to go in and try to work out a solution, because just simply bombing somebody who's done harm to somebody else doesn't help the situation. I'm just very proud of him for backing off and allowing the course to run where we didn't have to go in thus far. The United Nations, it seems, has taken over. And I hope that this will be a final resolution, because Syria has agreed, you know, with some conditions to give up those chemicals. And I think just spreading them through bombing would not have been the answer. So, again, I think the president proved that he can take it. No matter how people criticize him, he can take the criticism and do the right thing. And I think backing off was the right thing. And it's not just backing off, but backing off with a potential solution to the problem.
Scott, is this a victory for
well,
President Obama?
I'm glad to know he can take it, because he's the biggest buffoon on the world stage right now. You know, I'm not real happy when I have to look to the president of Russia to be the voice of reason and the great diplomat in the world. But let's be honest. Let's give credit where credit's due. Putin saw an opportunity. He took it. Now he looks like the hero. And Obama's sitting over there twiddling his thumbs and fiddling while Rome burns. I mean, you know, it just – I don't know how much more clear-cut evidence we need of his ineptitude to know that we're in real trouble, you know.
Let me ask you, which other president have you called a buffoon other than President Obama? You know, I am sick and tired of so-called, you know, loving Americans who put this president down at any option that they can. And when a president before him rushed off the war without the facts, did all the terrible things, put us in the debt that we're in now, I don't ever remember anyone on the right calling him a buffoon, or the left calling him a buffoon, because this is our country, and we're supposed to be together, especially in a time of war. So I resent the fact that you would call President Obama a buffoon. Yes, I said he can take it. You ought to talk to the New York Times. They allowed him to Putin to put information there. I mean, Obama would have the advantage of going to Russia and putting information about President Putin in the paper? I think not. So I think we need to recognize that President Obama is all of our president, not just the few of us who are on the left, as you call it, or progressive.
Well, no, I didn't ever call George Bush a buffoon, but I think you could spend 5 seconds on the internet and find a whole lot worse things that were said about Bush by, quote, leaders of this country. They called him much worse names than a buffoon. And a buffoon means someone that has not the sense to actually step up and make rational decisions. And yeah, I'm embarrassed when my president doesn't step up and actually act like a grown man and a leader. And it takes the president of Russia to settle a potential World War III conflict.
Are you saying that President Bush was held higher in the world by world leaders than President Obama is?
I can't answer what the rest of the world thinks. I know I don't really care what the rest of the world thinks.
You said that he was a buffoon in the eyes of the rest of the world. You just said that a few moments ago.
No, I said he was a buffoon in my eyes, and I think of the eyes of a lot of Americans.
No, you said he was a buffoon in the eyes of the world. That's what you said, Scott.
You know, I hope the rest of the world does see him for what he is, but unfortunately, the rest of the world has slept under the blanket of protection we've provided for far too long, and it's time that we actually step up and demand others take care of themselves instead of us always rushing in, always taking the lead. The United Nations wants to put
Iraq a mistake?
I don't have that kind of information to actually go in. I don't have the top secret clearance to know the things that President Bush knows. I have given credit where credit's due on President Obama. I think the operation to get Osama bin Laden was well executed. I think he did what he needed to do. But in this case, if anyone objectively looks at this serious situation and thinks that President Obama was anything except completely inept and completely over his head, I think you're not looking at all the facts.
Well, I think that we could look at the same situation, and I would never call the president, no matter who it is, a buffoon, but it turned out that in the case of Iraq, President Bush was wrong, I mean, about many of the facts, and yet we've gone in there, we've spent every last American dollar we could spend. We're still spending it in Iraq, and you're not calling him a buffoon. You're saying now suddenly you don't have all the information President Bush had. You don't have all the information President Obama has.
Do you think we'd be safer today if Saddam Hussein were still alive and still running Iraq?
I have no idea.
Paul on Government Street. Paul, good morning. You're on the air with Scott Wilfong and Faye Williams.
Good morning. I was actually calling in to speak about the Navy Yard shooting. I heard that's what the topic was going to be discussed. I read an article that I found very interesting because it quoted a Marine or a serviceman who was on site who said that they had weapons, but they didn't have ammunition. And apparently that's a result of the Clinton administration basically making our military bases gun-free zones for the soldiers and not allowing them to have personally owned weapons or ammunition for their issued weapons. But the serviceman said they could have stopped the shooter by the time he had killed three people. And I found that interesting because I've read some other studies that show that there's never been anyone who successfully killed more than three people unless it was in a gun-free zone. And yet these guns keep miracling themselves into the gun-free zones in the hands of maniacs where law-abiding citizens are not allowed to have them.
All right.
I think he must have read the he must have had the information Yeah, the gun-free zones seem to be somewhat unsafe. It seems like all these mass shootings happen in gun-free zones. Even the theater, which Colorado actually does allow for concealed carry, but in the theater shooting, that specific area is off limits to concealed carry. Theaters are. So, yeah, I think that just goes back to the you know, chasing our tails here, trying to find solutions that just don't work. Making gun-free zones is just an attractive thing for a criminal. That's where you want to go.
Let me just say, Building 197 was certainly not a gun-free zone. You know, we've heard in the news that the security guards need guns there, so that is not an excuse. There were police on the base. There were police at the gate. There were park police. There were city police there within 7 minutes. There were many guns around, so I think that's not an excuse for not getting him. I'm not saying that they... You know, it would have been easy to get the person, but there were definitely guns on the scene.
All right, on another topic. Yesterday, several hundred University of Alabama students and faculty members invoked Governor George Wallace's 1963 attempt to block the enrollment of black students in Tuscaloosa as they demanded an end to segregation in the university's fraternities and sororities. Together, the mostly white group marched within sight of the president's mansion, one of the only structures on the campus dating back to the Civil War. Tracy Golston, a black woman who's pursuing a doctorate in American literature at Alabama, says Mr. Wallace's legacy continues to permeate the university, which has nearly 35,000 students, about 12% of them black. Now, this is a big story, as I just read from the New York Times today. The segregation in the fraternity and sorority system in Alabama is mirrored in many places across the South, including Louisiana State University. Scott Wilfong, should these sororities and fraternities integrate in 2013?
You know, I mean, there's two things come to mind. One is I always believe private organizations, which, let's be honest, a sorority or fraternity is private, even though they're on campus, should have the right of free association. But kind of the bigger thing that comes to mind is just, you know, we're 5 years into the administration of a first black president in America, and race relations in this country are worse than they've ever been. What has happened in this nation? I wish I had an answer for it, but I can only tell you that we're much worse off.
You're blaming this on our president?
I'm not blaming it on Obama. I'm saying I find it somewhat ironic that we finally elect a black president, and yet we've gone much worse. We're much worse off than we were 5 years ago on race relations in this country.
Faye Williams?
Well, I think that's because the temperature in our speech, in our actions, that has risen so much. Since we've had a black president, it's almost as though there are some who are saying, you know, I wish we had left all these black people in Africa and picked our own cotton. That is the way that this president has been treated. He's been treated with so much disrespect. There are people who've been willing to allow the country to fail just to do a setback for this president and to make sure that he doesn't succeed. And I guess the end of that is to say so that we will never have another black president. I think, you know, when you look at the ULI situation, and when you look at what Scott said a few minutes ago about a buffoon, when we're in the, you know, on the brink of almost a war, and talking about the president that way, and others have done similar things, I don't think that we're coming together. He's absolutely right. Race relations are worse than ever before.
John in Mid-City. John, please be brief. You're on with Faye and Scott. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine. What's your question?
I just want to comment on the situation with the sororities and fraternities. And for the record, LSU, University of Alabama, state schools take federal and state dollars. Therefore, they are not private organizations. They are receiving benefits from state. They may be private, and as far as the name, they may have been founded private. But they're sitting on state campuses, and they benefit from the state. So there is no reason for any type of separation. I mean, it's not like a private golf club or something like that.
Thank you, John. I think he's got a good point, Scott.
You know, I think he does, yeah. And that's similar to Title IX, you know, when campuses were private, but they had to treat women equally in terms of sports. I mean, they still don't, but that's the law.
Well, yeah, I think if they're getting state dollars or public dollars, then they probably should be, or they should be given the option of, hey, if you want to move off campus, you want to meet your own expenses and take no money, then that's probably a good point.
Jim and Walker. Hi, Jim. You're on with Scott and with Faye.
Oh, I have to say the reason why race relations got worse is rather obvious. It is having Barack Obama in the White House has absolutely brought the races out of the closet. The people that, you know, they just sort of, you know, commented under their breath are now doing so publicly and loudly and via social media.
Well, but that's the point, is that you can't, anyone who criticizes the president on a national level now is a racist. The chairwoman of the Democrat Party of Louisiana said anyone who opposed expansion of Obamacare in the legislature did so because they're racist.
She didn't
well, that's
say
the kind
that.
Of irresponsible. Karen Carter Peterson, absolutely.
She
her
didn't
irresponsible
say that. She
comments.
Said there was racism involved. She didn't say everybody was a racist.
She said, I'll give you a reason why they're doing this is because of the black president in the White House.
Well, she did say that.
That's irresponsible.
She might be right, Scott.
For a state senator and a chairperson of the Democrat Party of the state to come out with that's why there's your answer why the race relations have gotten worse. You can't criticize the president anymore without being a racist.
Donna in Mid-City. Donna, you're on. Good morning.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that I think Ms. Williams is doing a fine job in her responses to your other guests. But I do have one question, and I'd like to know, Ms. Williams, opinion on the fact that I think racism runs both ways.
Racism runs both ways, Donna says.
Okay, in my opinion, that is not true. And in order for you to have racism, you've got to have the power to do something to someone. In this country, traditionally, African Americans or black Americans have not had that power. So we talk in terms of racism generally when it's somebody who has power over you and the ability to hurt you. We don't have that power as a rule. I know a lot of people even think the president has a whole lot of power, but the president has to go to Congress. He has to go to the people to get whatever done that he is trying to get done. So he can't just roll over us and do different kinds of things. So I don't think so. I think there can be prejudice, yes, both ways, but not racism, because we're talking about what traditionally the white people in the white race, not everybody, have done to the black race. And that's racism. But prejudice can be anybody, any culture, any male against female, one-eyed liberals against progressives and the like. That's prejudice or bias.
So the Black Panthers that stood outside a polling place in Philadelphia with batons threatening people who came inside to vote, that had nothing racial, that wasn't possible that those gentlemen were racist towards white people?
They were threatening people who wanted to come inside to vote? Is that what you said?
Yes.
I think they were there to protect people's right to vote. I would not have done it that way, but I think it got very serious in terms of our ability to vote, especially in the 2012 elections. I think somebody had to take on a way to make sure people who wanted to vote could vote. It isn't my way. I don't believe in violence or even the threats of violence. But, you know, people get moved to various things.
Paul in Opelousas. Paul, please be brief, Paul. You're on the air with Dr. Williams and Scott Wilfong. Paul, good morning.
This morning, I think it was a Starbucks, they decided not to allow guns in Starbucks. Privately owned company, no guns. Could LSU attempt to do the same thing, and would it be legal? Thank you.
Well, guns
yeah,
are.
Yeah, Starbucks.
The person from Starbucks said that he decided not to allow them to. It was merely a suggestion because it made people who were there without guns uncomfortable. He never said that he would bar anyone from coming in.
That is correct. They did not bar them, but they said they want people not to bring them. They came out against them. So, which, you know, that was a corporate decision. Could LSU do it? I think that's LSU's owned by the state, so that goes back to our legislature. I think they could. We already have technically LSU's a gun-free zone, which, you know, makes me a little nervous. So was Virginia Tech.
You'd like to see guns at Tiger Stadium on Saturday night, Scott?
I think you can have reasonable regulations on it.
Kevin in Kenilworth. Kevin, good morning. You'll be our final caller for Faye and for Scott. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. I just want to make an observation. After President Obama was elected, there were over 1,200 militias that formed around the United States.
All right. Kevin, do you think that's relevant to this discussion, Scott?
Right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That's the Second Amendment. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. I didn't write it. The Founding Fathers did.
Faye, you get the final word.
Yes, there is a law of reasonableness in everything that we do in this country, so I think reasonable regulation should be there.
Well, thank you, Faye Williams. Thank you, Scott Wilfong.
Thank you.
Let's talk again soon. And in just a moment after our break, we're going to talk to a man who is one of the most remarkable people to ever play Major League Baseball, Mike Marshall, Dr. Mike Marshall. He pitched in 106 games in 1974. That's 106 out of 162, and that doesn't include the postseason and the All-Star game with the Los Angeles Dodgers. He is a man who believes that pitchers should get more work, not less. His views are in contrast to those that are espoused by most people in the baseball world today, and we'll talk with him about the advent of the 100-mile-an-hour fastball. Now many pitchers are exceeding that limit, and what is it doing as far as danger to the pitching arm? Dr. Mike Marshall, who has a Ph.D. in kinesiology from Michigan State University, will be with us. Your number is 297-5633, outside the area, 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Back in 90 seconds with 1974 Cy Young Award winner Mike Marshall. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. J.C. Kane producing your number 297-5633. We're joined by Dr. Mike Marshall. He pitched for 9 teams in his major league career, and his records are still standing after retiring more than 3 decades ago. Mike Marshall holds the record for most appearances by a pitcher in one season in both the National and American Leagues, 106 times in 1974 with the Dodgers is the major league record. Good morning, Mike Marshall.
Good morning, sir. Nice to be talking with you.
Well, you once pitched in 13 straight games. Today, there's no way the management would allow that to happen to an ace pitcher. But you said, no problem, you could have gone 14 or 15. Why has the attitude changed so much?
Well, when you're afraid of something, you can't think logically. All they can do is, I'm worried about these guys hurting themselves, so we better not pitch them so much. We better not train them so much. They must not throw baseball very much. Well, that's what's caused the eruption of injuries. You, in order to be fit to withstand stress, you have to train. And the only way you get stronger as a in competition is to pitch competitively. They've got it backwards. They're not exercise physiologists.
Well, they say that pitchers are lasting longer now. I'm not sure that's true, but that's what they're saying. They're saying that, like, they shut down, as we know, Steven Strasburg last year at the end of the season. May have cost the Washington Nationals the world title. Was that a smart move?
No. No, not at all. Now, I've got to make a point clear. There are injurious flaws in the traditional pitching motion. The reason pitchers injure themselves is they, well, understand, there's no middle linebacker cross-blocking the pitchers. They are doing it to themselves. We have to remove the parts of the traditional baseball pitching motion that is injuring the pitching arm. Nothing else is going to stop it. You can't rest your way out of injury. You have to use your arm appropriately. Now, as you said, I pitched in 106 games and 13 consecutive games, and I believe I could have pitched in every game. I was never stiff, sore, or tired. If I didn't pitch the night before, I threw batting practice the next day. And you say, well, how the heck can that be? Well, everybody said I'm a physical freak. Well, I am. I'm 5'8.5" tall, and I don't have the... you know, all the leverage that everybody else have. But what I did have was a doctoral degree that enabled me to figure out the proper way to apply force that is not injurious. And I'm trying to give that information back to the world, but the uninformed, those that are ignorant of the facts of muscles and how they perform and how you generate leverage without injury, they just keep saying no. I think they're doing it trying to keep their jobs because they're not keeping injuries out. You realize that since they incorporated the pitch limits and the innings limits that the Tommy John surgeries have jumped up to 35 to 40 a year and held that amount for the last 10, 12 years. In other words, all this rest and all of the lack of training is causing these injuries.
Well, the New York Times story this week, which prompted my call to Mike, implies that because pitchers are throwing harder, which appears to be the case, although not substantially harder than they were in your day, but a bit harder, that that's causing injury. Is that bogus or is that a realistic viewpoint?
That's bogus. These guys are throwing 100 and more, Chapman, 106, with a motion that is injurious, and I don't, you know, that's why he can't start, because every time he does, he breaks down, so he's pitching an inning or two, and then I don't know how many appearances he makes a year, but I doubt that he's pitching more than 100 innings. I pitched 208 innings of closing pitches. So
yeah, you were pitching more than one inning.
That's right. I averaged 2 innings per appearance for the decade.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I could. The point is, if they would learn to use their arm correctly, they could throw without injury, and they would increase their release velocity. If he could throw 106, which has to do more with the muscle contractility than it does with technique, you can throw very hard if you have a high percentage of fast twitch muscle fibers, and that's what he has. But because it is injurious what he's doing, he's not able to do very much without suffering injuries of some kind. But the biggest part of this, and I tried to explain this, but it's hard to get across, is that if you're using the pectoralis major muscle, that big pec on the front, if you're using that to pull your upper arm forward, you're going to have shoulder problems. In order to prevent that, you need to turn the back of your upper arm to face home plate when you're driving forward. What that does is it brings in a latissimus dorsi muscle. I know everybody's now tired of listening to me, but if they could learn to do that, that's what I learned. And I don't know if you remember seeing me pick base runners off second base with an inside turn.
Yes.
Everybody says you're going to hurt your arm doing that. Well, what you do when you do that inside turn and you raise your arm up and you point the back of your upper arm forward second base and you throw it as hard as you can, you're engaging the latissimus dorsi muscle, and that's far more powerful than the pectoralis major, but more important, it keeps you from moving the pitching upper arm behind your back or behind your acromial line. That's what hurts the front of the pitching shoulder. That's the damage to the pitching shoulder. And that's what I did. And that, if you could tie to that, because you can inwardly rotate the upper arm very powerfully with the latissimus dorsi muscle, but if you add the forearm action of pronation, that is powerfully turn the thumb from up to turning down, you can protect the elbow as well, so you have no elbow problem. That eliminates the ruptures to the unilateral ligament.
Now, Mike, you pitched in an era where pitchers pitched over 300 innings. Starters did on a regular basis, made 40 starts a season. I'm just looking. Between 1943 and 45, you're in that group. Players born in that era, pitchers in that time period. Denny McClain, who was with us last Friday, is another one. But you got four Cy Young Award winners born in the two-year span: Steve Carlton, Tom Seaver, Jim Palmer, and Don Sutton. And they all regularly threw at or close or above 300 innings a season. Now, was it just something in the water in those years, or was the philosophy much different?
Well, I have to say that the pitching motion changed when they started to hook the wrist behind their back. And when you take the baseball out of your glove with your hand on top of the ball and you try to swing it back, you can't go all the way back. Your hand will stop. And then you have to raise your hand vertically upward. And when the pitching forearm is pointing upward, you start the elbow forward. That causes a reverse bounce to the forearm. And that's what ruptures the unilateral ligament. Back in our day, we had what we called the figure eight motion, where you take the ball out of your hand and you go down, up, and your arm went through like a figure eight action. And when you do that, you're able to protect the unilateral ligament because you're contracting muscles on the inside of the pitching elbow, where when you're raising the arm up vertically upward, you don't. And again, I know everybody's listening to say, oh, my God, what is all this? But it's all on my website for free. I have a video, Prevent Pitching Arm Injuries and Causes of Pitching Injuries, and even a baseball pitching instructional video. All is free. I don't charge for anything. It's on there for free. I'm trying to get people not hurt themselves. No pitcher I've ever trained has ever injured themselves. And I've had guys one guy came to me, and he said he throws 88 from the set position, 94 from the windup. What can I do to get my set position up? I worked with him for 3 months, and he threw 102 from both the set position and the windup. Well, so when they learn how to engage the latissimus dorsi, the increase in velocity is amazing. In addition, when you use the latissimus dorsi muscle, you can use the tricep brachii muscle to apply force, whereas when you take it laterally behind your body, you can't use the latissimus dorsi muscle. This was discovered back in the 70s, even during that time, that you can't use the tricep if you're bringing your arm laterally outside in a big circle, because you have to protect the back of the elbow.
Mike, I think we still have him, JC, at least I hope so, but he's obviously on a roll, Dr. Marshall is, and he's a man who knows his kinesiology, and you can imagine a guy who talks like this being in a dugout or in the bullpen with his coaches through the years. There had to be some unusual conversations with some people who were not as astute as far as the study of anatomy as Mike Marshall. Mike, did anyone ever offer you a job as a manager or a pitching coach, or did they think you were a bit too cerebral for the traditional major league mind?
Well, I don't know why, but I was naive. I thought that as soon as I retired from actively pitching, that I would receive offers from several teams to help train their pitchers, and it's something that I wanted to do. I wanted to show people that there's a way to pitch that's non-injurious and can be very successful. I heard from nobody. I contacted a few teams, and they would never respond. I have no idea what it is except for one story of interest. I worked with as an assistant coach. I was coaching college baseball, and I had an assistant coach that I taught how to teach pitching. And he went to a school, St. Mary's in San Antonio, and he taught the pitchers there. And after being there for a while and him having no injuries and always being in the top 10 in pitching statistics and so on, he got an offer from a major league club to come there and teach his pitchers how to do that. And so he called back and he said, "Jesus, it sounds great, but I've got to let you know that the stuff that I'm teaching is Mike Marshall stuff. You should probably talk to him." And they said, "We don't want that sumbitch anywhere around here. Excuse my French." And I don't understand why. I got nothing against owners of baseball teams or general managers. I would be there to help. I think it's a, you know, I have a doctoral degree. One of the requirements of a doctoral degree is to give back what you know. They say that to you when they let you come into the program. You don't just walk in. You have to be allowed into the program. And this is a requirement that what they do, because they give you a lot of things, a lot of knowledge and a lot of opportunities you don't get otherwise. They allowed me to take high-speed film. They got cameras to do so.
Well, Mike, I tell you, we're a little short on time, and you're a fascinating man, and I'd like to resume this conversation with you at some point. I know that these issues will still be a part of the game as we move into the postseason and beyond, and you're a guy whose viewpoints I think have merit because you did it. You walked the walk and pitched 106 games and 208 innings and 13 straight games. You did it. Mike Marshall, it's very nice to meet you and to talk with you today.
Yeah, my pleasure too, Jim, and I thank you for the opportunity.
Well, let's do it again soon. I would really like that.
Anytime you want, sir, I'll be available.
Well, thank you, Dr. Marshall. Take care, my friend. And we're joined in studio now by a lady who dances as prolifically as Mike Marshall pitched, Garland, Goodwin, Wilson of Moving Colors for more than 20 years. Thank you for stopping by, and you've got a huge event, as you always do, but this is a big time of the year for you.
It is, Jim. Thank you so much for letting me share about it. We're kicking off a season this year that does not have to do with guns or politics or even the good old American job of baseball, but it's called Color Me Rouge, and we are using the city as our stage, and we hope to attack the city in different venues with photos and media and performances, site-specific performance that will highlight the city. And we've started that kickoff by offering a wonderful party tomorrow night at the Crescent Condominiums. It starts at 7 o'clock, and we're going to do our second ever water performance in their beautiful pools. So we've left the stage, and we're diving into the water, and it's going to be a good event.
Okay.
To kick off the season.
Who will be performing?
There are eight dancers that are performing. Some of them are veterans. Our associate director, Carrie Clyburn, who's been a soloist for years, as well as newer dancers like Emily Roy, who just moved back to Baton Rouge. Nice to have a dancer return who moved back this summer.
Well, and the Crescent Condominiums, for those unfamiliar.
The Crescent Condominiums is a private residence across from the Baton Rouge Beach. And anybody that wants a sneak peek of their quarters, they're welcome to join us.
You can just show up at the Crescent Condominiums tomorrow
night.
Show up
with some money. Show up with some money, buy a ticket, we'll let you in.
Well, these have been challenging times, as we know, the last few years for arts organizations. How's Moving Colors done?
Moving Colors has done very well. And I don't mean that we're bringing in the millions, Jim, but our board of directors has really committed us to getting over some obstacles that we've been hurtling for nearly every year of our life. So it's a good year. It's a good year to cross over some of those obstacles and be able to look at a stronger financial and safer financial picture. But, of course, we love people to come to parties and buy those tickets. So,
all right. Well, you have a phone number or something you'd like to impart to our listeners?
I do. The best way to contact us at this point, since we are on site at a different couple of places, is by email, and that is contact@ofmovingcolors.org, and they can also call the office 338-0804.
338-0804, and put a 225 in front of that.
And I know that I am so short on time as we're wrapping up the show, but your friend and our past board president, Stephanie Regal, is chairing our Zombie Bash, and she just wanted to give me an opportunity to plug that. You can also reach those numbers as well if you want to run or if you want to perform Thriller, and that's 2 weeks away.
225-338-0804. And Garland Goodwin Wilson is living proof that dancing is good for you. After 20 years, you look as great as you always have, and you started out pretty great.
Thank you, Jim.
All right, thank you, and good luck with the Crescent Condominiums event tomorrow night of Moving Colors, one of the great entities in the arts community in our area. We'll be back tomorrow. Until then, for J.C. Kane, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to WRKF, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.